Welcome to Ouroboros Podcast, episode number 195. I am your host, Colin, coming to you from Bath. It's that time of year again. Well, actually, it's the first time that this time of year has meant this, but Doctor Who is back on our airwaves, so I'll be giving my usual review of the last episode of Doctor Who, Let's Kill Hitler. And as I've been doing with this series of Doctor Who, I'm not going to put the spoiler warnings on because it's already been broadcast in America, and the people who listen to my show in America don't really care about Doctor Who spoilers. So I'm not going to put putting the spoiler warnings up, so there will be a spoilerific review of the last episode of Doctor Who. And I'm sorry, Stuart, but this time I am going to spend some time talking about the Vuelta a España, which has been going on for the past couple of weeks, with some rather interesting stuff for British viewers. Well, I suppose it's interesting if you care at all about cycling. And yes, it's almost that time of year. The American football season starts next week as well. So yeah, I'm not going to be very popular for the next couple of weeks, I don't think. But what is popular is the music. And here's the first track. Here's another play for Tahiti 80. This is Easy.
No sleep, snowflake.
Tahiti 80 come from Rouen in France, and that track, Easy, is their last single, I think. Well, they've certainly released it as a single. And it's also available on their album, The Past, The Present, and The Possible. Really nice laid-back kind of indie track there. It's also got quite a good video, done by a Japanese animator they seem to work with a lot. And, yeah, interesting. Bizarre, but interesting. And so, of course, I'll be putting a link in the show notes to a video playlist. Worth checking out. Time to talk about Let's Kill Hitler, the last episode of Doctor Who. And I really don't know what to make of this episode. I get the impression that Stephen Moffat is deliberately messing with his audience. He is deliberately putting so many misdirections and so many confusions into his arc plots that I'm really not sure how he's going to bring it all together. There was so much going on in this episode, and so much of it was unexpected, that as I was watching it, I mean, I enjoyed it, but as I was watching it, I did kind of worry that he might be losing what is Doctor Who's core audience, and that's young children. So I did make a post in the Facebook group of the Black Dog podcast, and asked if people's kids were able to follow it. And the two replies I got, one from Lee Medcalf, who hosts the Black Dog, said that his 7-year-old did follow it and enjoyed it. And another Black Dogger named Gary Stead said that his boy followed it as well and thought it was really funny. So I guess my concerns were unfounded. But Lee did say that his younger daughter did lose interest quite quickly. I don't know. Maybe I'm being over-concerned on that point, but I am starting to get worried that these plots are getting too intricate and too convoluted. I can follow them pretty well and think they're kind of awesome. But I'm an adult. I've lived with Doctor Who for most of my life. I just worry that Moffat is gradually inching away from what Russell T. Davis tried to do when he brought Doctor Who back. The plot itself was one long misdirect. The story is called Let's Kill Hitler. And when that title came up at the end of A Good Man Goes to War, I did literally laugh out loud. That is just such a cool title. But what Stephen Moffat chose to do is have, I don't know, a 2-3 minute scene with Hitler, and then he gets shut in a cupboard for the whole episode. Which is kind of awesome, I have to say. I think there is a place for historical guest stars, shall we say. You know, people like Agatha Christie, Queen Victoria, William Shakespeare. But including Hitler on that list, I think, was dangerous. In a fun, romping sci-fi show, trying to approach Hitler is a risky thing to do. So I think Moffat actually did it really, really well with this huge misdirect. Because all the pre-publicity had the actor playing Hitler right alongside Matt Smith and Karen Gillan. But, like I said, he was in the episode for maybe 2 or 3 minutes. So, making this big, bold thing about having Hitler in the episode and then not using him at all, I thought was the best way to go, and I really did appreciate that. And it was also kind of awesome that Rory got to hit Hitler and tell him to shut up. That was pretty cool, I have to say. And another cool point was this Justice Society, or whatever they're called. I can't remember exactly what they called themselves. But having all these little people inhabiting the body of an Nazi officer and going around killing people, and later on inhabiting the body of Karen Gillan, was awesome. It's an idea that has been done so many times before. Yeah, you know, with things like the numbskulls and Herman's head and things like that. The concept of little people running about in a body. But having people miniaturized and then inhabiting a robot form of somebody they deem as a war criminal, that is a genius idea. So yeah, I did like that bit as well. Initially, I really, really didn't like the introduction of Mels. Having this opening scene and then somebody roars up in a flashy red sports car, you obviously expect it to be River Song. But then when Mels gets out and points a gun at the doctor and says, "Let's kill Hitler," it was bizarre. I mean, it was a total bait and switch. And then after the credits, we have this sequence where Mels is seen interacting with Rory and Amy when they were kids. If we'd had any indication that this person existed before this episode, I wouldn't have had a problem with it. But then to suddenly have her introduced and suddenly have her be such an important part of Amy and Rory's life, I mean, basically, she's the one who gets them together. It did seem like a bit of a retcon. But then we get to learn that she is, in fact, Melody. I mean, that's her name, Melody Mels. Which raises another question about circular paradoxes, with Amy naming her daughter Melody after Mels, but Mels already is her daughter, so how did that whole loop start? But that really isn't as aggravating as getting the sonic screwdriver inside the Pandorica, but I've ranted enough about that in the past. So this bait and switch, having Mels, Melody and River Song all being the same person, it's convenient. I mean, effectively, Amy and Rory did raise Mels, I mean, even though they are roughly the same age. I mean, all these flashbacks show Amy being the responsible adult one and Mels being the tearaway. That, I think, is what Moffat was going for, this idea that, in a way, Amy and Rory did raise Mels. But I'm not sure that's enough. As things stand at the end of this episode, Melody has still been taken away from Amy and Rory. They haven't got her back. And they know that eventually she will become Mal's. And yet they seem to be satisfied with that. I really don't think they would be. I think they would be absolutely desperate to get their baby back. And the knowledge that they had a significant impact on Mal's is good, but it's not raising a baby. And I really don't think that Amy and Rory would be satisfied with that. Having said that, we did see in The Impossible Astronaut a picture of Amy with a baby, so I think they are going to get back together with the baby Melody. But we'll have to see, and as things stand, it's a little bit unsatisfying. And despite the fact it's revealed that Mal's and River Song are the same person, her introduction into this story still comes out of absolutely nowhere and does smack a little of retcon. I'm also a bit dissatisfied with the way the Doctor survives the episode. I mean, being poisoned by River Song using her lipstick, I mean, that is such an obvious thing. I mean, I'm amazed that the Doctor allowed it to happen. I mean, knowing River's modus operandi of drugging people with her lipstick, I'm not sure why he allowed himself to be kissed by River Song. And then, of course, he dies and is resurrected by River giving up all her regenerations. Which, again, is far too convenient. Too many people are dying, actually literally dying, and then being brought back. It's happening too much. It's being overused. It really is getting to the stage where anybody dies and you expect them to be back up in the next 2 minutes. I mean, all right, you can say that for most sci-fi shows, but in this case, it's happening too much. In too many occasions, too many characters are dying and then being brought back in some way. It's only effective as a trope, it's only effective as a plot point if it's not overused, and this one has been overused. So overall, I did enjoy the episode. It's slightly flawed, not massively flawed, and it definitely feels like a middle episode, trying to get from point A to point B, and this is one of the steps that has to be made on that journey. I think it's an episode which is very difficult to watch in isolation, and it's also very difficult to rate in isolation. But that's what I've been doing for all the episodes, so I'm going to continue my pattern. And I think for Let's Kill Hitler, I'm going to give it a B minus. I can't give a full rating until I've seen the whole series and knowing Moffat potentially another series after this. As things stand, I give it a B minus. I think it was above average. I enjoyed it. Yeah, good stuff. So, moving back to some music. And the next track I've got for you is another play for Blue Chandelier, which is the solo project of Ravin Chand from Fairfax in Virginia. This is another track off his free-to-download album Crash and Boom, which you can get from his website. Links, as always, on the show notes. This is a really interesting track. I think it's a cool song, and I hope you like it. So here is Blue Chandelier with his track Chrysalis.
madeintheukshow.co.uk and follow the instructions. And remember, no coppers if you ever want to hear your music again.
Oh yeah, that is definitely what Irk would call an earworm. That was The Diction with their track Call It Revenge. And despite its rather dark and disturbing subject matter, it's one of those songs I found myself humming along to and singing to myself days and weeks after I first got my hands on it. The Diction come from Toronto in Canada, and that is the opening track of their EP called Finally, which is a rather appropriate title as it apparently took them 2 years to complete, having only recently been able to get their tracks mastered. And I have to say that the mastered versions of these tracks are pretty spectacular. They first got in touch with me on MySpace, which is somewhat quaint in the modern world, and they do seem to do most of their business on MySpace. But they got in touch with me on MySpace, and I heard the tracks. I liked them. Well, I really liked them. So I asked them to send them to me. And then I got a message back saying, can you wait until they're mastered? And the difference between the demo versions and the mastered versions was so significant. It really does make you appreciate how much can be done with the same basic material. So yeah, the mastered versions are really good. I really like that track. And I've got a few more lined up for future shows, which will be awesome. So yeah, let's get on with the least popular section of the Ouroboros podcast.
So if you want to know an awful lot about cycling and American football, you go and talk to
Colin.
I've been looking for a bumper to introduce when I talk about cycling for a while now, and that bit of audio I took from Irk FM episode 180, which Irk recorded on the Irk Crawl, 2 weeks ago, did seem rather appropriate. So, it's the Vuelta a España, the third of the grand tours of the cycling season. I mean, there are only three races which spread over 3 weeks, the Giro d'Italia, the Tour de France, and the Vuelta a España. Over recent years, the Vuelta a España has kind of been the poor relation of the other two grand tours, partly because of where it's placed in the calendar. It used to be earlier in the season, which made riders have to choose the Giro d'Italia or the Vuelta a España. And obviously both races wanted the best possible fields, so the Vuelta a España moved to the end of the season, here in late August, early September. The problem is that the World Championships are at the end of September, so over recent years, not only has the Vuelta a España failed to attract a really, really top quality field, the majority of riders being more concerned with winning the Tour de France or the Giro d'Italia, those top riders who do compete have a tendency of dropping out before the race is finished so they can concentrate on the World Championships. So in a lot of ways, the Vuelta a España is not the most exciting race. It tends to be lots of heat-blasted plains in the middle of Spain, combined with some rather steep mountains. But this year is slightly different. The field is still relatively weak, but the course design is quite different. We have lots and lots of mountain stages, and these are not like the mountain stages of the Tour de France, which tend to be very concentrated. You have 3 days in the Pyrenees and 3 days in the Alps. In this year's Vuelta España, we've had mountain stages and hard mountain stages right from the first week, and we're going to continue all the way through to the third. So it's a bit of variety. And we've also got Bradley Wiggins. Now, the way things are looking at the moment, Bradley Wiggins breaking his collarbone at the Tour de France could be the best thing that happened to him this season. The Tour de France does attract the absolute cream of the professional cycling peloton. So getting onto the podium at the Tour de France is very, very difficult, as it should be. And while Bradley Wiggins had a good chance of getting onto the podium at the Tour de France, at the Vuelta a España, with the riders he's facing, I think he's got a very, very good chance of winning it. And if he hadn't broken his collarbone at the Tour de France and therefore not finished it, he almost certainly would not have competed in the Vuelta a España, because the Tour de France was his goal at the start of the season. But since he only rode a week of the Tour de France, basically, he has the opportunity now to compete and compete really well at the Vuelta a España. Right now, he is leading the race, and he has been leading the race for the last 3 days. Granted, it's only a 4 second lead over last year's winner, the Italian Vincenzo Nibali, but still, I think he's got a really, really strong chance of finishing on the podium. And that would be great for British cycling. He has stated that he is riding this year's Vuelta as a preparation for the World Championship time trial race, which is going to be held in Copenhagen this year. Because the way things have worked out, the gap between the Vuelta España and the World Championship time trial this year is pretty much exactly the same gap that there's going to be between the Tour de France and the Olympic time trial race next year. So if he can do well in both the Vuelta and the World Championship time trial in 2011, there's a good chance he can do well at the Tour de France and the Olympic time trial next year. I think he might actually do well. I fully expect him to finish on the podium. I don't think he's going to end up ahead of Vincenzo Nibali when the race finishes in Madrid next Sunday. But I would be surprised if he didn't at least finish on the podium. So that's a very hopeful sign. The key stage is going to be on Sunday, tomorrow, where the race finishes on the Angleru, which is one of the steepest mountains that is used anywhere in professional cycling. This is a beast of a mountain. It's 5,161 feet above sea level. It's 12.5 kilometers long and has sections of 24% gradient. And that's insane. There are very, very few mountains that are used in cycling races which are that steep. I think the only one that comes close is the Monte Zoncolan in Italy. When it was first used in 1999, a manager of one of the cycling teams said, "What do they want? Blood. They ask us to stay clean and avoid doping, and then they make riders tackle this kind of barbarity." And that is a fairly standard feeling about the Angleroo in the professional cycling peloton. In 2002, David Miller got so disgusted with having to ride up this incredibly steep mountain when it happened to be absolutely torrential rain that just before he crossed the finishing line, he took off his number and threw his bike away, which was one of the most graphic protests at what cyclists have to go through that I think I've ever come across. So yeah, the Angleroo on Sunday, tomorrow, is a really, really big deal. And I honestly don't think that Bradley Wiggins is going to be able to finish ahead of Vincenzo Nibali on that stage. Wiggins has become a much, much better climber over recent years. There was a stage earlier in the Vuelta where he dominated up a mountain. But the Angleroo is something completely different, and Vincenzo Nibali has a much stronger and longer association with climbing. So I think Nibali's going to win, but fingers crossed. And we're in a position now where Bradley Wiggins can actually win a Grand Tour, which is brilliant. It's great for British cycling. Unfortunately, the other great British cyclist at the moment, Mark Cavendish, pulled out very early on the Vuelta, which I don't think was planned, despite the fact he is one of the favourites for the World Championships in a couple of weeks. I think he was planning to stay at least 2 weeks before the World Championships, but he had really bad form in the early stages of Vuelta. I think he was just exhausted after the Tour de France, and the Vuelta came a little bit too quick for him. So I don't think that's the best preparation for the World Championships, but I still think he is one of the top favourites to win in Copenhagen. But we'll have to see. So, yeah, I think that's all I've got to talk about with the cycling. So I guess it's time to play the next track. And here's another play for UNSIN, who come from Greece. Here's another track off their EP 0154. And UNSIN is the UN codes for dangerous substances. Kind of a cool name for a band, I think, and kind of appropriate for a hard rock metal kind of band. Yeah, really good stuff. So, from Greece, this is UNSIN with The Show. We'll be right back.
Let the finger dip in me, let the blood get to my veins. Step behind me if you can, let the show begin. Behind the red curtains and I'll wait. The crowd is not enough to hear my hate. I know you need more. I'll give you some more.
Guess you guys aren't ready for that yet. But your kids are gonna love it. We'll be right back.
of the play for the Nine Inch Nails side project, How to Destroy Angels. And that track, Parasite, comes off the band's eponymous EP, mini album, not exactly sure what you'd call it. But as far as I know, it's still available as a free download from their website. And as always, you can find the links on the show notes. So I want to briefly talk about a trip to the cinema I made this week. I saw a Spanish film called The Skin I Live In, which is directed by Pedro Almodovar and stars Antonio Banderas. The film wasn't at all what I was expecting and ended up being rather far-fetched and was quite disappointing. But it's not actually the film I want to talk about. It's an advert I saw before the film started. And it's quite a cool advert. It starts out at the top of a big hill with a guy on a skateboard playing a guitar. And gradually, lots of other people in armchairs and on skateboards, you know, on wheeled things, go down this hill and start playing this song. It turns out that this advert is for LucasAid. And yeah, I quite enjoyed the advert. But one thing I didn't enjoy was the realization that the song they were playing was Buck Rogers by Feeder. Now, Feeder were one of my absolute favourite bands in the late 90s and early noughties. And the realisation that Buck Rogers is now an old enough song that it can legitimately be covered did make me feel old. I mean, Buck Rogers was released in 2001, so it's 10 years old, but it really doesn't feel like it was 10 years ago. And the further realization that the Mercury Music Prize is announced this week, and I didn't even know the nominations were out, and more to the point, I don't actually care. That was another revelation to me, I suppose you'd say. Two foundations of my musical youth have been tarnished, I suppose. I just really didn't think that Buck Rogers was an old enough song to get covered. And covered relatively well, I have to say. The band that did it are an unsigned band called the James Cleaver Quintet, who were hired by LucasAid to do this. I have had a look at them, and their music is a bit more sort of thrashy and aggressive than I typically like to play, but fair play to them. They do a good cover of Buck Rogers, even if it is for an advert. So yeah, Feeder are an old enough band to get covered, and I no longer care about, or even notice, the Mercury Music Prize. My musical past is gone.
W-E-I-R-D, track of the week, Urbis, Leon Uris, Pork Chop, Milkshake.
But my musical future is still to come. And in the immediate future, we've got another play for the Austrian band X Bloom. They come from Vienna, have an album out now called X Marks the Spot, and have a quirky indie electronica sound and quirky subject matter as well, which you will appreciate when I tell you the title of this track. So from Vienna in Austria, this is X Bloom with their track Mushroom. See you next time, and remember, good music is infinite.
Listening to Colin and the Ouroboros podcast. Good music is infinite.